Welcome to the 12th House Podcast. I'm Michelle, the co-host and your head witch in charge here at Holisticism. I started Holisticism to help creative, intuitive, spiritual people actualize through their sacred work. And at the 12th House, that's what we talk about all day long. We give you tools to do whatever it is that you're here to do. That's going to be intuitive business practices like sales, marketing, branding. That also means learning about things like self-knowledge, spirituality, creativity, everything that you need to really expand as a person. So join us twice a week to talk about everything you could possibly need to get the expansion pack and jump to the next level. We're pretty fun. I think you're going to love it. Make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast and let's get into today's episode. Hi, Wallace.
Welcome to the 12th house. Hi, Michelle. How's it going?
Amazing. What if one day I was just like, terrible, everything is going wrong, this is the worst?
I feel like that would be real and interesting.
Well, I can't say that today because it's going great. I'm sitting out in our house in the desert in the studio. Mm-hmm. So it's a little warm, but man, it's very spiritually clear. And last time I was here, I got the chance to record with Emily Rousseau, our friend, our mystic, our desert poet. And we got to talk about alchemy. And every time I'm in the desert, I really do think about the sort of like archetypal experience. I think about the elements. I think about magic and spirits because it's so spiritually quiet out here. And talking to Emily about alchemy and the archetypes of alchemy and astrology and what that actually means from a spiritual perspective was so like, dang, dude, it just like scratched an itch that I didn't even know that I had. And I didn't know that much about Carl Jung's work with alchemy. I'm more familiar with Carl Jung's archetype work and his work on the shadow and the inner gold that we all have. And in this episode, Emily talks about really who alchemists were. They were not literally trying to make gold, although there's the myth that sometimes that happened or that people had the ability to do that once they had like spiritually ascended. Alchemy is more about alchemizing the internal, taking the lead or the shadow inside and turning it into gold. And so I love the just like bridging of a bunch of concepts that come up in today's episode that connect the dots. And I think a lot of things that many people who listen to this will be interested in, from psychology to archetypes to the shadow to the spiritual to intuition to astrology, it's all in there, to maybe even a little bit of science, you know, because we're talking about elements.
Love it. Okay, without further ado,
let's get into it. Emily, hi. Welcome to the 12th House Podcast.
Michelle, hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
It's been a long time coming. I keep being like, come on the podcast. And then our emails miss each other. Or you took a break from astrology for a period of time and now you're back. And I couldn't be more excited because you're the only astrologer I really trust with my chart.
It's really sweet. That's an honor and a privilege to handle your chart.
Yeah, you know me like you know me intimately and deeply because of my chart, but also because we're friends. And I just love everything about you. Your brain is off the charts. Like, wow, impeccable brain. Even with the epilepsy, as I think we can both admit. Maybe we could do without the epilepsy.
Even though we
both have it. But other than that, the brain is chef's kiss. Incredible. And you recently just taught a class on alchemy, right?
Yeah. And I did this thing for the first time where I made like a series of recordings. I guess you would call that asynchronous. Is that what the kids are calling it these days? So I have this like set of recordings that anyone can do at any time. And I did that even though I hate, as you know, the recorded world and I'm very scared of it. And I often don't record my classes, but I did that because I think alchemy is a sort of calls for this kind of thing where we can listen back over and over again and work through the stages and the processes at our own pace, you know? So that's, I did that as well, which, and then I had a seizure after I recorded all that.
You channeled all that information in your body.
So you know it's good.
Yeah, so you're saying your body was like, can't hold all of this, like need to upgrade to next level. I mean,
this like, is shake it off.
Yeah, kind of off topic, but we've talked about like the spiritual nature of our seizures before, because we both started having seizures like in our late teens when we were realizing things, going through things. And we also have talked about like potentially their relationship to Diet Coke, which I don't know, guys, maybe lay off the Diet Coke and the cigarettes. That might be.
We just talked about Diet Coke. You're right. Yeah. When we were in the same room. Yes.
But for you, and we won't go into this too much, because actually we've had a whole podcast recording on your podcast about epilepsy and its spiritual nature and our relationship to it. I think it's still up, right? In the world?
We did. No comment. I don't know what happened. I don't know. Because that was years ago and I've canceled my podcast and myself since then. So don't know.
Okay.
Well, but maybe.
Yeah, maybe it's floating out there in the ether somewhere, but it's been a few years. So what is your sort of like summarization of the manifestation of your seizures and maybe their relationship to spirituality or not at all? Like, where do you stand today?
I don't know. You know, when I do think about like the word epilepsy or the idea of epilepsy, I think of it as like it has me as opposed to like I have it. Like, I feel like it's a kind of zone or something that sometimes I happen to enter, but I don't feel that it's something like that adds to my sense of self or solidifies my perception of myself. If anything, it like makes clear the void at the center of the self. So I feel like it's like this labyrinthine space that then comes through and I move through it and things change. But it's very, very hard to say how things change. But I think like I'm a writer mostly, I guess, if I had to say what I am. And so I think epilepsy is interesting, or a seizure is interesting, when we're thinking about it in terms of language, because it really is like the limit of language. It's very hard not only to form words when you're in that state, obviously, or post-ictal, but then to describe that state. So it's really like a limit experience can, I think, take us to the limit of language.
It 100% does. I've never found the words to describe what it's like right before I have a seizure. And even when I'll see an example maybe in a movie or like hear the sound that I hear, it's still not exactly right. And it's like not in the world. It's not defined by the world or like by the masses, I suppose. And so it's almost impossible. Sometimes I'm like, does that even exist? Like what I'm going through, because there's no language for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, good way to put it.
Epilepsy is kind of like a tractor beam where like, I don't know. It's like this tractor beam that's sometimes following me around very closely. And then I might like accidentally brush by. And that's when I have like whatever my auras. And when I fall into it or get sucked into it is when it's like you're overcome with energy or whatever it is. And it is like touching something. Like the void is a good word, but like it does seem like you can have access to anything in that state. But the thing is, as soon as you leave it, it's gone. Like it's also out of you. Like you're out of it. It's so beguiling because you can't capture anything while you're there, but you know that you're touching something. That is the dumbest thing I've ever said, but does that make sense?
You're coming in clear. Yeah. No, I mean, it's true. It's beguiling. And in that sense, there's like an allure to it because it does seem to transcend ordinary experience and ordinary descriptors. The body does things it would not ordinarily do.
What you just said about it being sort of something beguiling that people might want, because I think there's something tantalizing about being special or tapped into another plane, where maybe the more egoic amongst us might be like, I'm channeling something and I'm a channeler and no one else can channel it. And, or not even egoic, just like that's their experience of it, right? I think we all want to hear like, oh, this is how I'm special. Like this is the special thing about me. And I feel like that's one of the main initial draws to astrology is people are like, but what does my chart say that's special about me? There has to be something in there and I can't read these glyphs. I don't get it. But can you please unlock for me what's special? Is that like a lot of pressure? I imagine that's a lot of pressure as someone who reads other people's charts to tell people that they're where their specialness is.
Interesting way to put it. Yeah, the specialness. This is why I'm not a popular astrologer, because I don't tell people how they're special. No, I'm kidding.
yeah, you're regular, degular, average, normal. Okay.
Yeah. You're super typical. No, I mean, it's very interesting if we think about all the kind of astrological signs or whatever as archetypes that get their significations and qualities from the planets that rule them or preside over them or feed them and then and whatnot, they are literally kind of not typical, but they're archetypal or archetypical. And so then we get to be special or unique via the ways that those planets are expressing themselves or those archetypes are expressing themselves in our own sky. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting because it at the same time shows us how we're special and unique, but then also shows us these like transcendent qualities or primordial images that these unique specificities connect to. And then that's where the interesting conversation happens, like between this and that.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I love archetypes.
Yeah. It's a lot of pressure, I guess.
Yeah. Because archetypes are like, you ain't that special, bitch. Like, archetypal experiences. Like I just,
get off it, yeah.
Yeah, I just went through having a baby and giving birth. And I couldn't, like, every day I was like, this is so normal. Like, so many people have gone through this thing. It's not that deep. It ain't that special. And then, but I was also, I'm like, but it's a miracle. Like, this is so, no one's ever done this. Yeah. Like, no one's done this the way that I'm doing this. And man, is that, if that's not the human experience of like feeling comforted by there's a pathway through this, but also wanting to balance the like, and I don't want to just be like everyone else, or I don't want to just like tread down the same road that everyone else has walked. It's a fine line. Or maybe other people don't experience that, but that's how I feel. How do you feel about it?
This is, I mean, any profound experience, I think, has that interesting like double quality of being hyper ordinary and incredibly singular. I felt that same way when someone I was close with died. Mm-hmm. I kept having that same thought, like, this is so death. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's like the only one of the few things we all have in common. And at the same time, like, this has never happened, you know, and like, where's the special phone line I can reach this person on? So both. And it's interesting because I think that's partly why maybe astrology, there's a tendency to put like a lot of stock in it, or just like totally dismiss it altogether as bullshit, to kind of go one extreme or the other. But the more interesting way or sustainable way to engage with it is as that thing of like this communication between something specific and something transcendent or archetypal, and sort of how these things correspond to each other to form a cool third thing.
I was just thinking about the stereotypes of astrology. I guess I'll clue everyone in on my thought process and how we've talked a lot,
yes,
about like the memification of astrology and how it's really like, yeah, stereotypes, the stereotypes of the signs or the archetypes. And to you, what's the difference between a stereotype and an archetype?
Some memes are really good.
They are. Some memes just hit and you're like, oh yeah, that's correct. That's the truth.
Yeah. There are points at which they converge, I guess, but I don't know if I have like a quick or good answer to that, because that's it's a sort of like beguiling question. But I think a stereotype can become an archetype when it's like we're using it to engage with something else, when it doesn't just stop at itself. I'm being perhaps abstract, but it's not like this equals this or a kind of literalness, but when we're like allowing it to open up or like tell us what the larger truth is beyond that thing. Because a stereotype generally it's bad when it like stops or shuts down,
yes,
the conversation.
Yeah.
Right. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I'm picturing like the tip of the iceberg where you would say like, yeah, whatever. Taurus loves snacks. Okay. That's the tip of the iceberg. But like, what does it mean? Like, what's underneath that? What is that representational or like a manifestation of, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. They might love snacks. It might be true, but it's not like the only thing about the Taurus sign.
Yes. And so might everyone like snacks. Like, yeah.
If you don't like snacks, I don't know if I trust you. Like, what?
You might be a serial killer. Right. Because, and I think that's maybe the problem people have with archetypes sometimes, like people's resistance to them being like, oh, they're stereotypes or they're somehow essentializing.
Oh, interesting. I never think of them that way as like, I don't think of them as one note, but I guess that's just because that's not my experience of them.
No, I don't think of them like that either. Yeah. But I think anything can be used as that. So I think sometimes people can use them like that. And that's why they sometimes, like in academia or whatever, like certain annoying circles get a bad rap. You
know? Yeah. When you were researching your alchemy class, did you do a lot of research into Carl Jung?
One cannot, or I could not, research alchemy, like, you know, even for a day without coming across Carl Jung, because really? He's the guy who really reinserted it into our heads through his research. And he sort of made the connection between alchemy and the unconscious, and that these alchemists in medieval, Renaissance, whatever times, one way to think about them is as people who are at work upon their unconscious or discovering elements of the unconscious. So he has a lot of incredibly interesting research on alchemy.
Yeah, I guess I've only experienced the shadow work part of Carl Jung, but he does often talk about turning the shadow into gold. And that's what that's like what alchemists did. So like, yeah. Boy, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, he does talk about that. Yeah. And obviously he, you know, talks about archetypes and the collective unconscious. And so he was very interested in astrology and alchemy and how these things are keys and systems and kind of interesting imaginative language to talk about these things. Like, to me, I could just talk like psychoanalytically or whatever, or use another kind of language to talk about these same phenomena, but like alchemical metals and planets and astrology, like these provide, in my opinion, like incredibly interesting ways of thinking and talking.
Yeah, they're frameworks. And like, we often use frameworks or mental models from things like, I don't know, economics or math, and apply them to the personal or the spiritual or whatever. That's a very interesting lens through which to look. What was like your biggest, most surprising learning, and maybe connected to astrology, like what you already know about astrology and archetypes with alchemy for you?
So I've like low-key always, since I started studying astrology many years ago, I've pretty much been studying alchemy too. Just I've never really like kind of solidified the research in the way that I just did. But to me, they are like sister sciences or sister arts, because one way of thinking about alchemy would be like as astrology or astronomy of the earth, you know, all of the alchemical metals correspond to a different planet up above. So they make possible this conversation, you know, one of these like hermetic astrological principles, as above, so below. Yeah. So to me, it becomes like very interesting and more expanded when these things are talked about together. So it's not really just, I mean, I guess it's called alchemy of the word. So it has that, which I aped from a Rimbaud poem. So it has like a kind of alchemical ring to it, but it's really an astrology class too, or a series of recordings too, because I could not talk about the metals or the alchemical stages without also talking about the planets.
I'm studying this thing called the Matrix of Destiny, and it uses the 22 major arcana and the archetypes of the arcana, but there's also different ways of like words used to describe them depending on the placement. And it's helping me, it's just providing me another lens through which to like understand each card, you know, or understand each archetype that represents the card or that's within the card. And then, yeah, connecting that to the different planets or like the houses of astrology. It just like, it helps deepen my understanding. It adds more flavor notes, right? Like it adds more body to, or muscularity to the thing, or skeleton to the actual thing, as opposed to being this like tissue paper thin blah blah. It's like, it's like a thick, thick and meaty. Okay. That makes so much sense. And now I'm just like, oh my God, let's talk about everything. Let's talk about every planet. Let's talk about every house. Let's talk about every sign. But I'm actually like really curious about what each metal, the metals that correspond to the planets or the,
yeah.
Are they metals or are they considered just like materials?
The alchemical metals, but I'll start with the outermost planet, or, you know, the outermost original planet, Saturn, corresponds with the metal lead. So lead is the heaviest, densest metal, and Saturn is, you know, represents this kind of like limit of consciousness. It's a visual limit. It's the farthest planet we can see with our naked eyes. So, you know, at the beginning of the alchemical stage or beginning of the creative stage, beginning of like any stage, we can sometimes be met with a very heavy, overwhelming, melancholic Saturnine feeling, which is, you know, embodied in this metal lead. It's dense. The alchemists often said that like the world and the work both begins and ends in lead. So it's not as if we're like starting with lead and then we're like deleting it and like slowly progressing on this hierarchical chain towards gold. It's, I guess some people might think of it like that, but it's more like every metal is present in every other metal. And so the gold is already in the lead, sun is already in Saturn, but we have to kind of extract them and sort of study them and see how they're interacting. And then eventually maybe at some point, you know, we'll get to the gold, but then we're probably going to, that's probably going to echo back to Saturn in some way too. So they all kind of contain each other, which is interesting and important, I think.
Can I tell you a weird fact? So Saturn always makes me think of like baby boomers, the baby boomer generation. And because it's like patriarchal.
The greatest generation.
The greatest generation, exactly. And, you know, that lead paint was a big thing during that time. And like lots of children were eating lead paint chips of the baby boomer generation.
I hadn't thought about that.
And there's this theory that like, that's why they watch Fox News, but really like that it contributed to like some stuff that's happening.
Wait, is that really something people say?
Yeah, no, legit it is. Like that a lot of people ate lead as children, and like it does contribute to the deterioration of the brain. So
it is poisonous.
Put that in your little pipe and smoke it. Take that if you will. Leave it if it's not. It doesn't feel useful.
Do what you will with that. We'll just make some like lead boomer associations. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, lead is poisonous. I mean, also the alchemists, well, some alchemists, right, were like literally working with these materials. So sometimes the descriptions that they have in these wild, very hard to read, bonkers, interesting poetic texts from the days of yore, long before the boomers, are kind of trippy. And the kinds of descriptions they're talking about in terms of like things you will go through as you're working with the metals sound like lead poisoning, you know, probably. So they were.
The call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah. The call's coming from inside. Correct. Yes. This is like some OG horror movie shit. And it's interesting because, you know, James Hillman, who's this amazing, I'm a huge James Hillman fan, and he was like a kind of Carl Jungian dude. I don't know how else to describe him, but he says that, you know, one way we can think about alchemy is madmen at work upon themselves, which we all are, of course, in some way. So I like thinking of it in that manner too. But yeah, I mean, there is a kind of madness or melancholia in literal or figurative or emotional lead. There's like a kind of overwhelmingness to Saturn. And I think that's why it gets a bad rap, or also just why it's called a malefic planet, because it represents a limit. We tend not to like limits. They remind us that we're human, you know, like the bones in the body are ruled by Saturn. So it's this important, heavy, intense beginning.
Dense.
That reminds us of our end.
Yeah. It's got density to it. It's thick. It's heavy. I personally love Saturn.
Yeah.
So unpopular opinion. I love boundaries.
Love boundaries. Yeah. I mean, well, I love Saturn too. I think I kind of hate the way a lot of people talk about Saturn.
Yeah. Like
as somehow like basic.
Yeah. Or something. Like I like the Saturn return. Saturn return's good. Like, why are we making it this bad thing? It's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's fine. Yeah. It's also like there's a gothness about Saturn that I think it's like just, you know, maybe good, maybe bad, but like perhaps a little bitchy.
I prefer direct, but whatever.
Yeah, I think, I guess we could also, I mean, I think that like a seizure is a total like Saturnine moment because there's a chaoticness to it. You know, like the chaos at the beginning of a work or at the beginning, middle end of a brain reset, to put it, I guess, euphemistically, has that overwhelm to it. And then like what happens when we're met with that overwhelm or when that overwhelm enters us, that can be rather interesting. Like, so then the next planet is Jupiter. And Jupiter also, I mean, people tend to talk about Jupiter as like abundance and like this like sort of joyous yesness, which yeah, but it's you learn when you study alchemy, or I learned, I guess, when I studied alchemy, that Jupiter is that because it has this energy of like a decisive moment. So it's like when we're met with Saturn, we are met with the everythingness. And that's partly why it feels like a boundary or a restriction, just like we were talking about with the seizure. But then Jupiter comes in, or the second alchemical stage comes in, dissolution, and carries with it or engines a kind of, okay, I'm going in this direction, like yes to this in particular. So it kind of breaks up that Saturnine density and shows us what's there so that we can make a decision. And like, it's interesting because in a lot of the like very visual alchemical manuscripts, you know, you're kind of like in the presence of Jupiter / dissolution when you see like a king and a queen or a sun and a moon, like in a bathtub or like in a puddle of water, or, you know, there's like water at this stage and things break up. That's the yesness or the optimism of Jupiter.
Ah, interesting. I always think of Jupiter as in Alice in Wonderland, the cookie that says "eat me" that just makes her grow like indiscriminately. That's Jupiter to me. Where it's
another like, epileptic movie.
Yes.
Movie book.
Yeah. Where it's like, yeah, boink, touch you and you're going to grow, but like you might outgrow your house. You wanted growth. Like, sorry, dude. I don't know what to tell you.
And Saturn, is Saturn then for you like the one that makes her little?
Yeah, Saturn's like, fucking chill. No, that's ridiculous. She needs to fit back inside the house.
She's small. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is the...
I can see that. Yeah, that's...
What's the metal for Jupiter?
Tin.
Huh. Interesting. You know what's so... Do you want to hear
this? It's a more malleable metal.
The stupidest thing that I had the realization of, like, last week, mm-hmm. I was using tin foil I was like, this is a sheet of metal. This is a sheet of metal that I'm like wrapping my bread in.
Oh my God. What did you do at that point?
I was just like,
or you just like,
I was like, I can't use this. Like, why am I using this? This is metal. Like, this is,
oh wow.
You know?
So did you just like drop the tin foil?
Yeah. I was like, this is too precious to like wrap leftovers in. That's what it felt like to me. But
that's the thought. That's interesting.
Okay. So tin is malleable.
Correct. Yeah. There's a, and this is the kind of Jupiterian dissolve and decision making. You can wrap stuff in Jupiter.
The ADHD is taking over because I'm like, what year is tin? I feel like tin, and when you get married, you know, like every year there's a gift that you give. I feel like it's like 5 years is tin, but. Whatever.
It's early.
Yeah. It's like
gold is like the fine, like the, like 50, right?
Yeah. Gold's like you made it. Platinum Jubilee.
It's like you're done.
Yeah.
Paper is like 6 months. Or something. I don't know.
Actually, yeah. The first year might be paper. I think you're right. What's the next planet after that?
I don't really go in like Chaldean order, but in my series of recordings, I go in like kind of like alchemical stages order. So for me, Mars is next. So yeah, Mars, which, you know about Mars. Iron.
That's right. Iron. Makes sense. Sword.
That's right. Is that an anniversary?
Armor. Actually, yeah, I think it is.
The iron anniversary.
Also very abundant during medieval times.
My favorite times, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Mars is like, Mars and Venus, I did that. That's sort of like one recording, because it's very hard to talk about Mars without also talking about Venus. They're in the myths, they're lovers, you know, and ex-lovers, and they get in trouble together. And, you know, Mars severs. All the planets have a different like nature. So Mars severs and makes war, and Venus conjoins. So Mars sometimes, or maybe at its best, we could say like fights for Venus or fights for Venusian things, like art and beauty. But there's this constant like interplay between the severing of Mars and the conjoining of Venus. And we can just like think about that in any human relationship, like, you know, all the ways we leave and love each other.
Yeah. And cleave. Right. And I was thinking about this today because I actually pulled this card. I pulled in the alchemy deck. I don't know if you have it, but I pulled Mars. And
I have an alchemy deck. I don't know if we have the same one. Which one do you
have? I have the Kim Kranz one. Do you have, it's like a hexagon.
No, that sounds cool.
It's really cool. I'll send it to you. But I really like it. And I was looking at what she drew, and it looks like, I can't remember if it's mitosis or meiosis of the cells, when cells separate and then they begin to like go on opposite sides, yeah, and be recreated into something new, and how like you need it. You need it if there's going to be like new life and growth. We need the separation and the cutting. And mm-hmm. Although it can feel like painful and violent, it's always for like the betterment eventually.
Yeah, I love that. And that's totally Mars. And I like thinking about it in terms of cells. And then of course, like where our own Marses are, it tells us something about how we go after that which we want, or that which we love, or what we fight for, how we fight for it, how we, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'm a Taurus Mars, so I obviously bring snacks.
Well, yeah, I had your baking actually.
That's true.
And then I had a seizure. I'm just going to keep making that joke. But it was very good, alarmingly good. So that's like very Mars Taurus. It's like, whoa, it's like disturbingly good. It's like so good. I would fucking kill for this. Well, yeah, baking is mad alchemical.
It is very alchemical. It's one of the reasons I enjoy cooking and baking so much, because it is like magic. It's totally magic.
Yeah, it's like cooking and baking. I do feel like there's something more like magical and alchemical about baking.
Well, it's definitely,
you have to be a little baddie.
And yes, and it's definitely energetic. Like, I know, yep, this sounds dumb, but if I'm in a bad mood, like my cake won't rise. It just won't. It won't do what I ask it to do when I'm like having fun and enjoying it. Like then it comes out like, and I'm also just like, whatever, it's okay if it comes out weird. It always comes out better. So Mars is iron and Venus is
copper.
Copper. Attractive. Mm-hmm.
More pliable, and it changes colors.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And
the green of Venus.
It's a communicator, right?
A conductor.
Conductor. Yep. Thank you.
Yeah. I often end up talking about where Venus is in people's charts, because I work with a lot of artists or a lot of people who are like making things, and it's, you know, where Venus is and what it's doing and who it's talking to and what it's surrounded by tells us something about like who's attracted to us and what we're attracted to. And
what's your Venus?
Scorpio.
Of course. How could I forget? Duh.
Underworld. In the eighth house.
Oh, sexy.
Something like that.
Okay, so Venus.
Yours is
Pisces.
That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how many sessions I have with people, it clears. Yeah. And then it comes back.
The whiteboard. That's probably good. I think about this a lot with people who are astrologers or who are therapists, that once you like know something about someone, for example, their chart, it might be hard if you keep it in your brain to like really see them and experience them almost purely, like without projecting stuff.
I'm always thinking like Venus and Pisces, Venus and Pisces.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like, oh my God, that's so Venus and Pisces of her. But like, I don't know. I would find that to be really difficult. My brain also, I think, works the same way as yours, probably a little bit because of the epilepsy where I'm like, I don't know, man, I read for you, but I can't remember a single thing I said. Like, I'm sure it was good, but I don't know. I can barely remember my own chart.
Hopefully it made you feel special.
Yeah. No, more just like, I don't know. I'm not holding on to that for you. Okay, so Venus is copper and the next Mercury's Mercury.
Mercury's Mercury. Mercury is a really interesting, I mean, Mercury is in a lot of ways like the essence of, or one of the essences of the whole alchemical process. It's the ruler of astrology too. So this idea of like as above, so below, or we can think of like the magician card in the tarot, like one hand pointing up, one hand pointing down. Mercury connects and is the messenger. And it's also the only entity in astrology that's not given like an either masculine or feminine signification. Mm-hmm. It can play for any team. It's roving, can go into the underworld, is not stuck on Mount Olympus. Mm-hmm. It's endlessly fascinating. And so there's a kind of secret alliance between Mercury and Saturn that a lot of people don't realize, but alchemy kind of tells us this, because when you get to the Mercury stage, there's a kind of callback to the first stage, to the leaden beginnings. So there, everything about Mercury contains a kind of doubleness. Obviously, like Gemini twins, da da da. But there's an interesting sort of like doubleness in the Mercury stage of the alchemical process, where there's a kind of darkening or a putrefaction or a decay, followed by like a animation or spiritualization. Like, so those two things together make fermentation. We can think about that in terms of food too. There's like a decay that's followed by some kind of new animation. And so Mercury has both of those elements. It's like you can feel the heavy weight of the beginning and then also the kind of uplifting holy shit moment.
That also reminds me just of like the singularity, being singular. Like if you can go everywhere, but no one else can, if you can be like anything, all things, but not just one thing, you're like, it's very hard to relate to. And like, it can never, you can sort of never be like, I don't know, caught or known. That's what I think of when I think of like Mercury or Quicksilver, right? Like it just is always like, boom, 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 like bouncing through your hands. Like if it escapes its glass capsule in like a thermometer, like it's gone. You know, it's hard to scoop back up.
It's ungraspable, which is why it's the ruler of poetry and language in a lot of ways. There's like this slipperiness or plasticity to it energetically and materially. But also, I think, what you're saying, like, I think we're sort of Mercury overloaded now. I mean, Mercury like rules technology. So we could think about like, just modernity in general as having this kind of like ultra liquidity where we're all, everyone's everything. Or so I think these systems also, I think, solidify this idea that there does need to be some solidification.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything can be Mercury.
Yeah. I think that people like really are seeking belonging in something or like losing themselves in a way. Right. Or don't know themselves, even as they like quest to understand themselves. Because we're in such a mercurial time, I suppose.
Overload. Yeah. Everything solid melts into air, that kind of thing. And I'm forgetting where your Mercury is. Of course.
Aquarius.
Now I can picture it. Yes. So mine's Libra. So we both have airy Mercury's.
Makes sense.
Very epileptic.
Extremely. I mean, like seizures are violence. They're self-violence. I think that's what Louise Hay says in her book of like, you can heal yourself. She creates these like connections to different maladies. And I remember reading it with my therapist actually, because my old therapist was really cool. She was like definitely a little witchy lady. And it was self-violence, like that's when seizures and epilepsy come through. Yeah. And I feel like that's definitely also true. That hits for me at least.
Yeah. And they do that.
Totally.
They throw you around.
You feel like, and you, when you said lead earlier, you feel like you've been hit like by a truck or like an anvil has been dropped on you when you, after you have a seizure. It's just like everything has been sucked out of your body. All of your, you would like spent all of your energy pushing and then, or sixth house, right? That's the house of like work. That's, that always reminds me of like Sisyphus
labor, yeah.
Pushing the boulder up the hill and like using all of your energy to do so. And just like being totally zapped afterwards.
Yes. My son's in the sixth house. So I always, that's sort of, I'm always trying to wear myself out. We've talked about this before, but yeah, I think that's really true. And also, yeah, there's like this immense violence that's then followed by a kind of like total ataraxic, like nothing, just so peaceful. It's almost like a peace never before known, you know?
Mm-hmm. One that like your bed never feels, has never felt as good when you're like so exhausted after like a really hard day's work. And also I think that's why some of us are like, we love hard work because it does, it is very satisfying. It's like physically satisfying and mentally satisfying to like, to have the emptying out, especially if you're someone who's like brain, let's say you're a Mercury, Mercury with an air sign, like your brain is always going, like you're always thinking, you're always creating and imagining, and to just like have some stillness is a welcome change sometimes.
Just wrap it in tinfoil.
So did we get all the way through? Now we just have the sun?
Moon and sun.
Oh yeah, moon. Moon's got to be silver.
Silver and gold.
Silver and gold.
Silver births gold. The moon births the sun. The moon is mother to the sun. That's how they talk about it.
Really?
It's very beautiful.
That is beautiful. Mm-hmm.
There's something more ancient in a sense about the moon because it rules the night. You know, it comes out at night when we freak out.
That's, I like that. I'm reading this little book to Rhodes about going to bed at night. And in it, it says, don't be afraid of the dark. The dark is just a blanket that tucks in the earth so that the earth can have sweet dreams. And I'm like, this is fucking existential. Like this is, is this a spiritual text? Like what is going on here? This board book? Oh my God. But that makes me think of like the, just the almost even like maternal nature of like the moon tucking in earth, like with the darkness. And so it can dream and imagine and relax. And they also say that your brain, when you sleep, gets like a shower, you know, that's when your brain heals.
Yeah. So true. Yes, it's very interesting because all the alchemical manuscripts, which there's like a lot of shit ton of slides, almost a like upsetting amount of slides in these recordings because there's just so much imagery. There's so many like strange psychedelic imageries in alchemy, and really it's all about the narrative or story, and we could see it, I guess, as like an archetypal quest or process of king, sun and queen, moon or silver gold, meeting, taking off their clothes, doing like sitting in a hot tub, being conjoined by Mercury, like separating, having spirits come into them and exit them, fighting. There's a lot of like decapitation. I mean, it's just wild. It's like the metals and the planets are kind of getting tortured in a sense, or getting coaxed in order to find gold or find whatever, find shit out about oneself and the world. So it's really interesting, all these images of like the sun and the moon and them kind of getting put through the ringer.
I kind of like love the personification of the planets, of the metals, because it does make them, it takes it from like theoretical, how do you think this thing would act, to like, well, what would you do? What would you do if you were in a like sexy little hot tub with, you know, your partner? Like, what do you think would happen? What do you think would happen if you, I don't know, took a sword and sliced that person's head off? Like, I don't know. Where would you be acting from? It just makes it a little bit more like, I think astrology, magic, alchemy can feel so other, and like you need to have this encyclopedic knowledge, which you do, Em, but like in order to even begin to grasp it. And I think that really turns people off from it or trying to understand it. And so they go to an app, right? Or a meme, and there's nothing wrong with this, but like they give their power away in a sense, and they give their understanding of themselves away because they're looking out, like we look outside of ourselves for the answer because we think we don't know enough, but you actually know so much because it's just human. It's like, it's nature, right?
I think you're right. There is a kind of like, oh, I have to know so much. So there's an overwhelm and then that kind of blocks people from it. But yeah, you don't really need to know anything at all, actually. You kind of just have to like look around.
Yeah.
And in a way, the like astrology, alchemy, whatever, or I see them as ways to kind of like, just to see. It's like a way of seeing. And so we could look at, you know, we could look around a room then and things become a little more interesting and magical and make correspondence. We can make correspondences because it's like, oh, there's like something that reminds me of gold, or there's something that feels like a little bit Saturn-y, and it doesn't have to be, you know. So there's all of these different ways that then like these primordial things that can feel really abstract or just like forms or ideas are alive already. You know, we don't have to make them alive. They're all around us. We just have to see them. So in a way also, I guess we could say, you know, you're talking about like looking inside of the self, like the sun, which is like, you know, gold, or in sometimes talked about as like the quote goal of the work, is the heart. You know, it's the center, obviously, of the solar system. It's also our own heart. It's the fuel of our charts. So one way to think about it is like just getting to know one's heart, or which is not easy, but it's also very easy. You know, it's like it's both.
Yeah. And the sun in the tarot, like, represents children too, and like the pureness of like who you were as a child, or like childlike wonder and fascination and curiosity, which always, yeah, like that's Leo too, right? Leo and the sun are connected. I always think of Leos when I meet them as like they have that childlike wonder sometimes, not always, but
yeah, that little kid on the sun tarot card.
So I did not think that we were going to go into metallurgy. Is that a term? Is that a word? Like, is that the right word? I feel like it is. I did not think we were going to go into metals, but like obsessed, love, huge fan. So for, and I've already taken
you. Kind of like we talked about archetypes.
We did. You know? No, I think we really did. Like there, it's just a different form of archetype. Like it is archetypal.
Yeah.
Sorry. If you're mad about it, don't be. It's archetypal. That's an archetype. And also like completely relatable because we use these things in our everyday, and they exist across cultures, right? Like we have reference points for them in their utility and also in what their representation is in art, in literature, blah, blah, blah. And that's all that an archetype is, right? It's like a reference point. If someone just sat through this and was like, that was so fucking cool, but like, how do I think of like gold in my natal chart? Like, what would your advice be to them to maybe start seeing the planets or like exploring their own chart through the alchemical metals?
Well, okay. So the reason I think why this conversation is archetypal is because learning about the metals and learn, and it's not even learn. I mean, you can like do the recordings or like read about alchemy or read Carl Jung or whatever, but a lot of it is just noticing. It's like very just common sense stuff, in my opinion. So it's archetypal because learning about the metals and learning about the planets tell us how the signs get their qualities. So, you know, Leo represents all of these things, you know. Leo is like, you know, has these significations of being like a lion and courageous and prideful and heartfelt and whatever, because it's ruled by the sun, because there's like this gold attribute. So all the, you know, signs like Virgo, whatever, they're taking their archetypal vibes, modes, qualities from the planets and their corresponding metals. So that's just one way, like you can, you know, it's like, okay, your sun is in Virgo. So that means your sun, and by your sun, I mean my sun, my sun is in Virgo. So that would mean that my sun is being ruled by Mercury, because Virgo is a Mercury ruled sign. Right. So you really don't even have to know like jack shit about the signs. It's really just like kind of thinking about the metals and the planets and their qualities which you can get to know in a deeper and kind of more like practical everyday way, in my opinion, through the metals, just because they're like there and, you know, tinfoil and shit. So, you know,
do you also think about like when you're thinking about the sun, do you think about how gold and mercury like interact?
Sure. Yeah. Like how does mercury house or feed or fuel gold? What is it doing to it? And then like other conversations open up from there, but that's because then it's like, okay, well, where is your mercury in your chart and what is it surrounded by? What is it going through? So, and you know, this idea that the sun is like the fuel of the chart, that's how the ancient astrologers thought of it, as like that which kind of moves the chart forward, and then the moon as a more kind of like daily light, you know. And that's obviously because the moon is our emissary, you know, kind of whipping around us much quicker than any of the other planets. So the moon then kind of disseminates and feeds us the sun's light in slices and cycles.
Yeah. Gosh, I could listen to you explain astrology all day long. Honestly, I could probably listen to you explain anything, but sometimes I'm not smart enough to like totally capture what you're saying when it comes to literature and philosophy, but astrology, I'm there with you. Definitely.
Are you like, what you mean? Like when I'm newslettering, I guess is what you're referring
to. I'm just, sometimes I just let the words wash over me, 'cause I'm like, I don't even know what that means, but like, that's a me problem. That's not an Emily problem.
No, it's probably my problem too.
No.
That's funny though. Yeah, just let it wash over you. That's good.
I really believe in like, you know, osmosis. Like if I just sit in something for long enough, it'll come through, you know, when it's supposed to.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. I mean, that's like, just like look at your chart, you know, just like think about this. I don't know. Yeah. It's like really just be with it.
Yeah. What is the next thing that you are like itchy to explore in this world, like that you're itchy to sort of research and like that you want to like dive a little bit deeper into, or maybe like, what are you chewing on right now that you're like, that's very much satisfying you?
Well, I'm going through all of Dante's Divine Comedy, like Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradise, canto by canto, on my newsletter. So I'm always like in the Dante world. Which one could also view obviously as like an archetypal alchemical journey.
Yes. Did I tell you that I stayed in the villa of the Alighieri family passed down from Dante when I was in Italy? That's where the holisticism team stayed. We stayed in their like ancestral home. It was amazing. It was so weird.
I mean, well, okay, we'll talk about that off air, but that's wild. I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're definitely still obsessed. Jesus. They're obsessed with Dante.
They're definitely not over it.
Yeah, they're not. They're like, did you know that this guy, we share some DNA. Like it's, we are simpatico. Yeah, they were not over it. And the guy who like his, whatever, his progeny, his ancestor who runs the space now, he was an astrophysicist astronomer. And so he like wrote a book on astronomy and Dante, like connecting the two. Mm. Anyway, he was weird. But
I'd like to read that book.
Sick. Yeah, he was like kind of a jerk, but also like an interesting jerk, you know?
Same.
Yeah, I know. As I said it, I was like, also, yeah, I mean, relatable.
wow, that's fascinating. Yeah, so Dante, and I mean, I'm still not over alchemy. Like I'm done with the project. People can get it on the site, but I am still studying and alchemy and reading Carl Jung. I weirdly like was fatedly, I have fatedly acquired the complete works of Carl Jung in a strange way that I won't get into, but I feel, I kind of like to think of reading as fate. So I kind of, I'm like a really uptight in some ways, like Virgo, who like tends to assign myself things. And then I enter into a hell of my own making where I'm just like, here's everything I must read by X, Y, and Z date. But I am happiest when I'm just kind of being cosmically assigned things. So I've been cosmically assigned Carl Jung, which it's like this insane library of his.
Yeah,
shit.
That's so quite an assignment, because there's a lot, and it's not like light, easy. It's not like Babysitter's Club. It's not like the lightest reading in the world where you're just like, oh, I can just like get through this. So simple. Like, you know, that's a lot. Not, no.
It's more like My Little Pony.
My Little Pony is a spiritual text. I don't know. There's some MFA out there that is currently writing their thesis on My Little Pony as a spiritual text. I'm sure of it. I'm absolutely positive.
Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah. I'm sure of it too. I mean, that was my favorite show. I think about it a lot.
Yeah, it's worth a rewatch.
It's pretty based.
With alchemical eyes, you know, everything can be alchemy.
Yes. Highly recommend.
Incredible.
That's the assignment.
Okay, everyone, hop on YouTube, start watching some My Little Pony. Let us know what you think. Solveig and Collect.
Tag us in the comments.
Sure, yeah, let us know. I'm sure that there's lots there. Wait, also weirdly, I feel like this I should share with you. In Italy last summer, we took a chocolate making class from this chocolatier who had these tattoos. He was really cool. He had these tattoos on his wrists, Solveig and Coagula. And I saw them and I was like,
the alchemical motto. Yeah.
I was like, are you an alchemist? And I kind of said it as a joke because like I thought he would just, you know, chocolate is just like the melting down and the bringing back together of solids.
Yeah.
And
he's like, so yeah, bitch, like, I'm making chocolate right now.
Exactly. And that's what he said. He was like, no, he's like, yeah, I'm a chocolatier, but also I run the metaphysical bookstore here in Perugia where we were staying. And he's like, you should come by, but it's only open on Fridays from like 2 to 4. And I was like, that's amazing. Extremely Italian of you to only be open on Fridays for 2 hours. But it was very, you never know who's out in the world who considers himself an alchemist. Like we're kind of everywhere, you know?
We're out there and some of us are Italian. Yeah, I mean, Solveig and Coagula, right. I mean, all alchemy is, and we could also see astrology as this too, like is that guy's tattoos, like just different ways of dissolving and coming back together. And that's what a relationship is too in some ways.
That's what being a person
that's
is.
That's wild.
Yeah. Anyway, Emily, God, you're so smart and you're so cool and you're so pretty. And I could just talk to you forever about literally anything. But how can people find you and how can they sign up for the class? Because to your point and what you said earlier, like it's something that you probably want to listen to over and over again to just like let it sink in. So where can people grab the asynchronous alchemy class?
Yes. On my website, myfirstandlastname.com, there's a little tab that says Alchemy of the Word. You click on that, just add to cart, check out. You can always email me. You can Instagram me. Also, when you sign up for it, one of the perks, as I see it as a perk, is you get like a secret link to a special like kind of session with me that is not available to the public.
Oh, I was going to ask if this is the session. The session that I did a birthday session with you this year. That was very impactful where we talked about Deccans.
I love that session.
Yeah, me too. That was like, that was the best. It was awesome. So it's not that, but it'd be more special than that.
It's, I don't know about more special, but something. It's alchemical.
Different. It's off book. It's like,
no, anybody can do a birthday session. Yeah, you can. My books are open, as I've heard people say. So you can. Yeah, I'm available for that kind of thing.
10 out of 10 recommend. Also, just I'm going to throw this out there. Emily and I used to do quarterly readings. I would ask her to pay her. I would pay her to do quarterly readings for me because it's just helpful. It's helpful to like touch base, not just on your birthday because you're like overwhelmed on your birthday, you know, like it's very helpful. I need to rebook with you because I'm now.
Yeah. Quarterly is good. Yeah. Cause you, not only do we get to hang, but it's also like, you kind of get to know what's going on in the sky regularly. Yeah. We did have quarterly readings and then I, went into hiding, but
yeah, I didn't take that personally. So don't.
Thank you. It's all good. Good. It's not you, it's me.
But I really like that because you develop a relationship with your chart that isn't just like you're going on vacation to it. It's more like, yeah, it's like this piece of art that you're revisiting over and over again. And you can really like create a conversation, be in conversation with, as opposed to like passively experiencing it or whatever.
For sure.
Cool. Thank you so much. I love you.
I adore you. I love you. This was great.
The 12th House is produced by yours truly, Wallace Miller-Blancher. Our theme music is made by Nathan McKay, and our wonderful editing is done by Softer Sound Studios, who you can find more information about in our show notes.